had nevertheless followed the path of the words on the page. His voice choked with emotion as he read his father's valediction.
"What is life?"
read Master Miyamoto.
"It is the flash of a firefly in the night. It is the little shadow which runs across the grass and loses itself in the sunset."
Valerian had found the words wonderfully uplifting, and looked down at the wolf head picked out in gold thread over the breast pocket of his shirt. The symbol was that of the Mengsk family, and Valerian bore it proudly whenever he was in a place of safety. On those rare occasions they ventured into public, he had been warned not to display anything that might link him to his dad. Given how his dad was portrayed in the media, that was a sensible precaution. It had been 2 years since he had seen his father, standing on the underground platform where his ship, the Kitty J, was berthed. It was a moment of confused emotions for Valerian. He had been sad to see his dad leave, but even as a youngster, he had sensed the tension between his mum and dad and grandpa. He sensed a familiarity to the drama before him, his dad leaving and his mother left behind, with his grandpa there to deal with the emotional fallout. Even though he hadn't thought of that moment in such terms, he'd sensed the reality of them, as though they'd been spelled out. His father had knelt beside him and fixed him with his gaze.
"I would have liked to spend more time with you, Valerian," said his dad.
"Yeah," agreed Valerian, "I'd have liked that."
"There's much to be done if you are to be a worthy heir, but I have work to do, and you cannot be part of it yet. You are not strong enough or wise enough, but you will be. You are going to hear a lot of bad things said about me in the coming years, but I want you to know that none of it will be true. What I am doing is for the good of humanity. Always remember that."
And Valerian had remembered it. Despite his mother's reservations, Valerian eagerly watched every report on the UNN concerning his dad. He saw bombings, assassinations, and the spread of revolution throughout the sector. Some of those reports were plainly so ridiculous that even a 9-year-old could see through them. But others appeared to be unvarnished truth that needed no embellishment. Images of burned bodies and mangled corpses being carried from wrecked Confederate buildings that had been torn apart by explosives. Burning Confederate vehicles targeted by one of the many insurgent groups that were slowly but surely accreting under his father's banner and leadership. Factories belonging to the old families were bombed, each target carefully chosen to cause maximum disruption to the economic infrastructure of the Confederacy. Of course, none of the news broadcasts spoke of this, but Master Miyamoto made Valerian always look to answer the most important question of all when looking at his dad's handiwork. Why? Why was that particular factory destroyed? Why was that particular official killed? Each question forced Valerian to think beyond the simple, bloody facts of the act itself and to search for deeper purpose than simply the causing of harm. Though it was hard watching so many images of death and suffering, Valerian felt sure it was for a higher cause. These people were part of the Confederacy, and they had murdered his dad's parents and sister in cold blood. Master Miyamoto had urged Valerian not to see things in these black and white terms, but such deeper consideration stood little chance of recognition in the face of a youngster's loss. High-minded ideals were all very well until you were put to the test of having to hold on to them in the face of personal tragedy. The Confederacy had robbed his dad of his parents and his sister, and Valerian had lost two grandparents and an aunt he had never met, never got the chance to know, and now never would. If that wasn't worth some bloodshed, then what was? Valerian knew that his dad was wanted throughout Confederate space, a wanted terrorist and murderer. But these were labels hung on him by his enemies, so Valerian didn't pay them much attention. He knew who his dad was, and knew that when he saw him again, whenever that might be, he would not be the disappointment he now realized he had been when they'd first met. He recalled his mother tearfully telling him that his dad had called him bookish, effeminate, and weak, an admission she later regretted, but which could not be taken back. In that moment, Valerian had made a personal vow to himself that he would never be thought of that way again, and had thrown himself into physical exercise as though his life depended on it. There had been some communication with his father, but it had all been done through his grandfather, and was sporadic at best. Icarus IV was the fifth place they had lived in 2 years, and looked like it wouldn't be the last. Valerian tried not to get comfortable in any one place, knowing an imperious command could be delivered at any time, instructing them to move on. Valerian's grandfather would sequester yet another outlying Umojin outpost, or colony to hide them, and the process would begin again. The necessity of this was brutally demonstrated when Valerian had once complained about the need to move incessantly and begged his mother to not uproot them again. She had agreed not to move on for a little longer, but one night Valerian had woken to the sound of shouting soldiers, gunfire, and the flash of explosions.
"Not a word, not a whimper, Vile, my darling," said his mother, dragging him from his bed and handing him over to a Umojin soldier in battered combat armor.
Valerian's memories of that night were confused and fragmented, but he remembered being carried through the night, its darkness split with stuttering flashes of fire. He'd taken a tumble as the man carrying him collapsed, but was picked up again, realizing at the same time that the first soldier had been killed. They'd been hustled onto the dropship that was always prepped nearby, and as it lifted off in a screaming, rocking ascent, Valerian clung to his mother and said,
"Mommy, will Daddy ever come for us?"
"Yes, honey," she replied, "he will, one day."
As the pilot flew them to safety, Valerian had lain with his head in his mum's lap for hours, letting her stroke his golden hair and soothe away his worries. He heard her crying and pretended to be asleep, letting her think she had succeeded. Valerian never again complained about their need to keep on the move. It was hard to be always on the move. But as hard as it was for him, with no real friends and no sense of stability to his life, he knew it was harder still for his mum. She tried to hide it, and denied it whenever he brought it up, but Valerian knew she was quite ill. Exactly what was wrong with her he didn't know, but he could see the gray pallor of her skin, and the way the weight seemed to melt from her bones. No matter how much she ate, which wasn't very much at the best of times. At night he heard her racking coughs, and cried as he thought of her pain and his inability to do anything about it. Through all of this, Valerian's most pressing question was, why? Why did his dad not come to see her? He knew his grandfather must have sent word to him that Juliana was ill, but the weeks and months passed with no sign of his dad. Didn't he care? It was hard for Valerian to reconcile the mounting evidence of his dad's indifference to their plight against the image he'd cultivated since a youngster. The subject of his mum's illness was always quietly dismissed whenever he brought it up, but Valerian knew that if whatever was wrong with his mum was serious enough to warrant its being kept from him, it must be extremely serious indeed. A succession of physicians had come and gone, but none of them appeared to offer anything that stopped his mum's terrible, hacking cough or enabled her to put on weight. He'd heard words like long-term, inoperable, terminal, non-viable, medicable. And yet, others he didn't understand. But the meaning was all too clear. As each doctor arrived, Valerian felt a flutter of hope, but as each one left, that hope was crushed. Evidently his grandfather was not about to give up, even if it seemed his dad already had. Valerian felt his anger grow and tried to suppress it. One of the few teachings of his dad that had stuck was that anger was a wasted emotion. "Angry people do stupid things, Valerian," his dad had said. "Speak when you're angry, and you'll make the best speech you'll ever regret. So when your anger rises, think of the consequences before you act." He put down his book and closed his eyes, trying to calm his seesawing emotions, but finding it difficult with all the noise coming from downstairs. It took a second to dawn on him that the noises from downstairs were not normal for this time of day, and he sat up as he caught a measure of the urgency in them. Valerian heard the sound of someone crying and made his way quickly to his bedroom door. Something was definitely going on. So he made his way downstairs, heading toward the large room at the rear of the house that served as a warm gathering place in the evening. He heard shouted oaths and more crying, and a cold hand seized his heart as he suddenly wondered if something had happened to his mum. Valerian broke into a run and skidded into the room from which the sounds of crying were issuing. The room was full of people, all staring in rapt attention at something displayed on the flickering holographic image of the scene viewer in the corner of the room. Valerian's first feeling was relief as he saw his mum standing in the center of the room, but then he noticed that there were a lot of people here who looked as though they'd just been given the worst news imaginable. A few heads turned to face him, their faces streaked with tears, then quickly turned back to the unfolding drama on the scene viewer. The image was fuzzy and dark, but from here it appeared to be showing a large black ball.
"What's going on?" he asked. "Why is everyone so sad?"
"Oh, my darling Val," said his mum, rushing to him and sweeping him up in a hug. "Oh, honey, it's Korhal."
"Korhal? The planet Dad comes from? What about it?"
His mum pulled back, as though not sure she should tell him what was going on.
"It's okay, mum," he said. "Just tell me."
"Korhal's gone, honey."
"Gone? How can a planet be gone?" said Valerian. "It's too big to be gone."
His mother struggled with her words, her eyes streaming with tears.
"I mean, not gone exactly, but..."
"The Confederacy has launched a thermonuclear strike against Korhal," said Master Miyamoto, appearing at his mum's side. 1,000 Apocalypse-class nuclear missiles, according to a military press release."
Valerian felt his stomach lurch and terrible fear freeze his limbs.
"Korhal's destroyed? Dad? Is Dad dead?"
"No, no, he's alive," said his mum. "We had word from your grandfather not long after the first news reports came through. Your dad's fine."
Relief flooded him, and he disengaged himself from his mum's arms as everyone in the room continued to watch the image on the scene viewer. He stood before the flickering image of Korhal, watching the black disk of the world as nuclear firestorms raged across its surface with elemental fury. The once bountiful and green world was now a superheated sphere of blackened glass and phantoms. Even with his limited understanding of the physics of nuclear detonations, Valerian knew that 1,000 missiles was an inordinate amount of overkill. Such an overwhelming attack would have killed every living thing on the planet's surface.
"How many people lived on Korhal?" he asked.
"More than 35 million, said Master Miyamoto. "All dead."
The thought of such devastation was humbling. That so many people could be wiped from existence in such a short period of time was unbelievable. What manner of madman could ever think to unleash such wanton destruction?
"The Confederacy did this?" asked Valerian.
"Men without honor did this," replied Master Miyamoto.
Chapter 16. Flames burned with a greenish glow from the bombed-out munitions plant, but Valerian couldn't tell if the color was the result of ignited chemical spillage or a fault of the scene viewer. Fire crews fought a futile battle with the blaze, and medics dragged screaming men and women from the wrecked interior of the building. Valerian felt no sympathy for these people. They were employees of the old families, and therefore part of the system that maintained the bloated, corrupt form of the Confederacy, the same men who had destroyed Core Hall 6 years ago. The image panned from the blazing plant to a sandy-haired young man standing at the edge of a perimeter enforced by Confederate Marines, clad in full combat armor and looking eager to use the heavy gauze weapons they carried. "Another atrocity unleashed by Arcturus Mengsk and his sons of Core Hall that forces us to number the dead in the thousands," said the reporter, his voice appropriately outraged, and mixed with not a little relish, thought Valerian. "An unknown number of bombs placed with uncanny skill throughout the Ares munitions factory has resulted in its complete destruction. There is no word yet from official sources on the number of people murdered in this latest act of terrorism, but one thing is certain, it will be high. Back to you, Michael." Valerian muted the sound and shook his head as the image of the burning factory was replaced with the neon-lit chrome interior of the UNN studios on Tarsonis. The broadcast was a few days old, and he was under no illusions that much of what the reporter had said was true, which was a rarity these days. The Sons of Core Hall. An appropriate name, thought Valerian, one apparently coined by his father in the wake of the nuclear attack on Core Hall, as he began rallying fragmented and scattered bands of revolutionaries to him in his bid to topple the Confederacy. Those ragtag soldiers had been molded into an army that was, if what he was hearing from his grandfather was true, proving to be a grave threat to the continued existence of the current regime. Though to hear the reports of the UNN, Arcturus Mengsk was a madman, a lunatic who made raving pronouncements over the airwaves of his supposed divinity and the alien creatures that used mind-controlling drugs on the Tarsonis Council. On those rare occasions where the UNN played snippets of his father's broadcasts, they were so chopped up, edited, or manipulated that even a child could tell they bore no resemblance to their original content. It had been 8 years since Valerian had last seen his father. 8 years of forced relocations and moving from planet to planet as they kept one step ahead of Confederate assassins and kill teams. Whether or not such killers were still after them was a moot point. It did not do to take chances when their lives hung in the balance. This hideaway was a particularly bleak refuge, thought Valerian, though it at least had the benefit of relative proximity to Umoja, for covertly delivered supplies and a steady stream of news that wasn't weeks, if not months, out of date. Valerian got up from his bed and stretched, thinking that perhaps he would go for a run, doing a few circuits of the orbital along its outer ring before returning to his medical digitomes of oncological research. Tethered in orbit above an inhospitable rock named Van Osten's Moon, despite the fact that it was not a moon, having nothing to orbit, Orbital 235 didn't even warrant a name, such were its remoteness and insignificance to anyone else. He supposed he had only himself to blame for the tedium of the orbital, as it was a destination he had picked from a list of suitable candidates, after recognizing the name from an archaeological report penned by a Dr. Jacob Ramsey that Valerian had read 2 years ago. Ancient ruins had been discovered on Van Osten's Moon, and Orbital 235 had been shipped across space and converted from its original function as a base for mining operations to one of archaeological discovery. The expedition had been abandoned due to lack of funding, and the ruins never fully explored, much to Dr. Ramsay's chagrin, from the frustrated tone of the report. But Ramsay's loss had been Valerian's gain, and he had leapt at the chance to discover ruins that might be genuinely alien, having long ago discarded his collection of fossils unearthed in various gardens and riverbanks. So far, he'd made a single trip to the barren rock, a desolate, craggy wasteland, with the merest scrap of an atmosphere to its name, with an escort of soldiers to view the ruins. The surface of Van Osten's moon felt as though one were walking on something that ought to be a piece of something far larger, but where this intuition had come from, Valerian had no idea. The atmosphere was gritty and cold, like breathing in on a frozen winter's day. Though breathing apparatus was not required, the thin air made it all too easy to become lightheaded and disoriented. To avoid arousing the attention of the Confederate Exploration Corps, shipments of exploratory equipment were coming in piece by piece, and it would be some time before Valerian had assembled enough kit to begin a full examination of the ruins. But what he had seen so far had been awesome in its breathtaking scale, awesome in the original sense of the word, as in capable of producing awe, wonder, or admiration. Not the watered-down colloquialism it had become, where a pair of new shoes could be called awesome. Perched on the edge of the world, overlooking what might once have been an ancient seabed, the ruins towered over the mesas around them, spiraled nubs of broken-down towers and collapsed caverns that were too enormous and geometrically perfect to have been created by anything but an intelligent hand. In everything Valerian saw, there was a curious fusion of the organic and the artificial. Weathered walls were laced with strange-looking alloys within the natural rock, and canyons, mountains, and caverns had been artfully engineered to their designer's needs. He found vast and airy caverns roofed by rounded, rib-like vaults and curved tunnels that stretched deep into the surface of Van Osten's moon. Though he was glad the site had been left largely unexplored, Valerian had to wonder at the stupidity of the bureaucrats who had withheld funding for such a wondrous find. The sense of scale and the seeming age of the site were astounding. The deterioration of the rock suggesting spans of time more akin to geological ages rather than that of any time period comprehensible to humans. Who had built the structures was a mystery, one that Valerian felt he could solve, had he but the resources and time. Though his father ensured that he and his mother were never short of money, the mineral find he had discovered just before their first meeting had turned out to be a seemingly never-ending source of funds, one that was now jealously guarded by a veritable army of soldiers, tanks, and Goliaths. Valerian knew that time was against him. With his father the most wanted man in the galaxy, it was only a matter of time until the hounds were snapping at their heels again, and they were forced to move on. His mother's sickness had already forced him to halt his exploration of the alien ruins, but the actions of his father forced him to leave them behind. Either way, the end result was the same. Valerian continued with his stretches, knowing that a hard run would work out some of his stress and anger toward his father. It was difficult to be angry with someone you hadn't seen for so long. But Valerian only had to think of his mother's condition, and the familiar, smoldering coal of his bitterness would flare into life once more. A nervous knock came at the door to his room, and he said, "Come in, Charles." The door opened, and a young man, only a few years older than Valerian, entered the room. He was dressed in an immaculately cut suit, and his head was crowned with a shock of wild red hair that seemed at odds with the blandness of his features. Charles Whittier had become part of the roving band of fugitives a year ago, an aide, servant, equerry, and general manservant, who had arrived at the instruction of his father. Valerian was sure Whittier was reporting to his father, but what was not so clear was why. Valerian played dumb, but for all that, he did not trust Whittier. The man was a capable valet who attended to Valerian's needs with alacrity and competence.
"Good morning, sir," said Whittier. "I hope I'm not disturbing you."
"Not at all," said Valerian. "I was just about to go for a run."
"Ah, then I fear I may have come with a summons that might inconvenience you."
"What is it?"
"Your mother asks to speak with you," said Whittier.
Valerian made his way along the steel-walled corridors of the orbital, the fluorescent strips set into the ceiling and walls, bleaching everything of life and color. It had once been a mining installation, and on such a facility, visibility was more important than aesthetics, a concept Valerian could understand, even if he didn't subscribe to it. Everything on board Orbital 235 was simple and functional, as was to be expected where space was at a premium and burly, largely unskilled men were expected to spend a great deal of their time. The air had a dry, recycled quality to it, and Valerian found himself wishing for the 100th time to be back on Umoja, with its scented air and copper skies. He walked at a brisk pace, his body now in the throes of its teenage development and changing daily. He was still handsome to the point of beauty, his skin flawless and his hair golden. His features were in transition from boy to man. But he could already visualize the form they were going to take and knew they would be perfect. Whittier walked alongside him, his legs seeming to move at twice the speed of Valerian's just to keep up with him. He was slender and apparently fit, but there was little vigor to the man, a trait Valerian was blessed with in abundance.
"How was she when you spoke to her?"
asked Valerian.
"Much the same, sir, though there was a certain animation to her today."
"Really? That's good. Any idea why?"
"No, sir," replied Whittier, "though she did receive a communique from her father."
"How do you know who it came from, Charles?" asked Valerian. "Did you look at it first?"
"I most certainly did not," replied Whittier. "The very idea. Your grandfather always sends a communication at the beginning of the month. It is the beginning of the month, ergo it is from your grandfather."
"Beginning of what month? We're in space, Charles."
"I keep a record of the diurnal rotations on Umoja and Tarsonis to keep track of our time relative to them. In such dislocated circumstances, I find it helps fix oneself if there is a predetermined point of reference to cling to."
"You've traveled a lot in space?"
"More than I have cared to," was Whittier's noncommittal answer.
Valerian wanted to ask more, but felt he would get little in the way of an answer that meant anything. So let the matter of Whittier's previous travels go, and concentrated on the summons issued by his mother. Juliana Pasteur was not a well woman, and her health had only deteriorated over the last 6 years. After his 15th birthday, Valerian had demanded to know what was wrong with her, and at last she had told him the truth of what the doctors had discovered, though sometimes he wished she hadn't. His mother had been diagnosed with a carcinoid tumor, a rare cancer of the neuroendocrine system. The cancer had arisen in her intestine and grown slowly over the years, which was why it had taken so long for her to suspect there was more wrong than she realized. By the time she'd consulted a physician, the cancer had already spread to her liver and begun to attack other parts of her body with unthinking biological relentlessness. Its progress had been slow but steady, robbing her of her vitality and stripping the meat from her bones. Not even the most advanced surgical techniques could defeat the cancer without killing her in the process. Valerian had cried with her as she told him, and gently guided him through the same reactions she had experienced. Denial, shock, anger, sadness, guilt, and fear. She was going to die, and had made her peace with that. It was more than Valerian could do.
He had immediately ceased his visits to the surface of the planetoid they circled and thrown himself into researching his mother's condition, despite the apparent hopelessness of the endeavor. Perhaps because she had been told she could live for several more years before death finally claimed her, his mother had tried to dissuade him from wasting his time looking for a miracle cure.
"Sometimes fighting to hold on to something you love can destroy it in the process,"
she had said to him one evening, holding him as he cried.
"Let's enjoy the time we have left, Val. Let me watch you grow and live your life. Don't waste it chasing windmills."
But nothing she said to him could penetrate his need to do something. No matter that this was an enemy he had no means to fight, he discovered that not even the most advanced intrascopic lasers, devices capable of targeting specific areas of the body with precise amounts of heat, nor the latest drugs or even nano-brachytherapy could defeat this foe without first killing its victim. Valerian, however, was a Manxk, and he did not give up easily, requesting fresh digitomes and the latest researches from the top medical institutes on Umoja and Tarsonis, via safe routes to avoid compromising their security, of course. "Sir," said Whittier, and Valerian started. He hadn't realized they'd reached his mother's room, and wondered how long he'd been standing there. "Are you going in?" asked Whittier. He took a deep breath.
"Yes, of course I'm going in."
Valerian sat beside his mother's bed and held her hand, wishing he could pass some of his own vitality onto her. He had plenty to spare, so where was the cosmic harm in evening the balance? But the universe didn't work that way, he knew. It didn't care that bad things happened to good people and was entirely indifferent to the fate of the mortal beings that crawled around on the debris of stars, no matter what those who believed in divine beings might claim. His mother sat upright on her bed, her skin pale and translucent, as though pulled too tightly across her skull. Her hair fell around her shoulders, its golden luster now the sickly, jaundiced yellow of a chronic smoker. She was still beautiful, but it was a serene beauty, bought with the acceptance of death. Valerian found it hard to see her, fearful that if he looked too long he might lose grip on his emotions. At times like this he cursed his father for the lessons of emotional control.
"Have you been to your ruins today, Val?"
she asked.
"No, Mum," he said. "I haven't. I don't go to them anymore, remember?" "Oh, yes, I forgot," she said, waving a bony arm before her. "I have trouble remembering things now, you know."
Valerian looked around the room, its austere functionality putting him in mind of a mortician's workspace. He hated the reek of defeat that filled the room.
"Are you thirsty?"
he asked in lieu of something meaningful to say. She smiled.
"Yes, honey. Pour me some water, would you?"
Valerian filled two plastic cups with tepid water and handed one to her, making sure she had it held in both hands before releasing his grip. She lifted the cup to her gaunt face and sipped the water, smiling as she handed it back to him.
"Charles told me you received a message today."
"I did,"
she said with a smile that served only to make her face look even more cadaverous than it did already.
"It's from your grandfather."
"What does he have to say for himself this month?"
"He says your father is coming to see us."
The cup of water fell from Valerian's hands. The spire of rock soared above Valerian like the horn of some massive buried narwhal, its surface pitted and worn smooth by uncounted centuries. He ran his hand across the surface, feeling tingling warmth through the fluted surface of the rock that was quite at odds with the chill of the air around him. Sheer cliffs of curving rock arched up overhead, a natural canyon that Valerian suspected had once been roofed by ribbed beams of stone, but which now lay scattered and broken at his feet. Frozen, gritty winds howled as they funneled through the canyon, lamenting the fall of so mighty a structure, and Valerian wondered what great catastrophe had occurred here to cast it down. The sky rippled through the thin atmosphere, stars pulsing in the far distance, their light already millennia old. He pulled his thick jacket tighter about himself and adjusted his goggles as he descended the loose rubble and scree slope that led to the colossal cave mouth ahead. He had ventured within this cave before and felt a deep sense of connection to the past within its shimmering hybrid walls. To know that long-forgotten hands had crafted this place with ancient artifice was an electrifying sensation, proof that life had existed in the galaxy long before the arrival of human beings. The secrets that might yet be buried here were beyond measure, and Valerian longed for the opportunity to plumb the depths of those mysteries, both for the sake of knowledge and for the rewards it would bring. Valerian paused as he took a moment to savor the solitude, smiling to himself as he realized that this was probably the most alone he had been in his entire life. He was the only human being on this rock, and the freedom of that sensation was intoxicating. The news that his father was coming to Orbital 235 had made Valerian surly and irritable. He found himself unable to concentrate on his researches, and his mother had even berated him, something she almost never did. The only peace he found was on the surface of Van Osten's moon, alone with his thoughts in the ruins of a forgotten race of alien builders. What had brought them here, and what had become of them? These were mysteries Valerian felt sure he could unlock, were he but given the time. Time. It all came back to time. Time he, and more especially, his mother, didn't have. He'd managed to persuade Charles Whittier that he could travel to the surface of Van Osten's moon without escort and had landed one of the orbital's two flyers at the mouth of the largest canyon complex on the surface. He wore a pair of loose-fitting cargo pants and a heavy, insulated jacket. Over his back was slung a rucksack filled with a comm unit, surveying equipment, and food and water. He wore a slug thrower and a shoulder holster, and his favorite sword was belted at his hip. He wanted solitude, but he wasn't about to venture into alien ruins without taking some precautions. The journey down the rocky canyon had been easy going so far, but his breath was still tight in his chest, and he slipped the mouthpiece of a small aqualung canister over his nose and mouth. A squall of dust blew off the ground, and Valerian looked up to see the orbital's second lander flash overhead, circling and coming into a light at the mouth of the canyon. He cursed at the interruption and had half a mind to just carry onward. To hell with the new arrival. But he forced the thought down. The lander touched down without fuss, and within moments the side hatch opened and a tall figure emerged into the twilight world of Van Osten's moon. Valerian recognized him immediately, and his heart hammered on the cage of his ribs. There was no mistaking the powerful cut of the man, even from this distance. His father. Arcturus Mengsk descended the ladder and began the trek to meet his son. Valerian saw that the man was dressed similarly to himself, with heavy-duty workwear and rugged boots. Like Valerian, his father carried a pack over his shoulders and moved with the natural assurance of a man used to being in control. As his father approached, Valerian took the time to study him. Arcturus's hair was still dark, but the first signs of gray were appearing at his temples and in his beard. Only in his mid-30s, his father's ongoing war against the Confederacy was evidently aging him prematurely, though he was still an imposing, proud figure. Despite the thin atmosphere,
His father seemed untroubled by his exertions and maintained a steady pace toward him over the rough terrain. He waved at his son, and, despite himself, Valerian waved back. His mother had once told him that people often found themselves going out of their way to please his father for no reason they could adequately explain. Valerian wondered if he too had been affected by that reality-warping effect. Arcturus dropped over a fallen slab of rock and took a deep breath of the thin air.
"Brayson, isn't it?" said his father.
Valerian removed the aqualung canister and said,
"That's it? That's your greeting after 8 years?"
"Ah, you're angry," said Arcturus, pausing and taking a seat on a smooth boulder. "A natural reaction, I suppose. Do you need to berate me for a while before we talk as men? It won't do any good, but if you feel you must, then go ahead."
Valerian felt the angry outburst he had planned to deliver wither in his breast, and the angry retort on the tip of his tongue become stillborn.
"Right," he said. "I might as well get mad at these rocks for all the good it would do."
"Words spoken in anger are just hot air, Valerian. They rarely hurt, so what's the point of them? There are no words as ultimately destructive as those which are ultimately considered."
"You'd know about that," said Valerian. "The UNN is making you look like some kind of crazed madman."
Arcturus waved his hand.
"No one believes what's on the UNN anyway. And the more they vilify me, the more people are waking up to see that I have the Confederacy worried."
"And do you have them worried?"
His father stood and came over to him, looking him up and down as though inspecting a prime specimen of livestock.
"Oh, I'd say I do. The Confederacy is about to fall. I can see the cracks widening with every day that passes. My father and your grandfather knew what they were doing, but they weren't thinking big enough."
"And you are?"
"Very much so," said Arcturus,
nodding in the direction of the cave mouth Valerian had been heading for.
"Now, what say you show me what's been occupying your time on this barren rock?"
Valerian nodded and set off without another word, picking his way down the slope toward the yawning cave. Its scale was immense, and it took them a further hour to reach the bottom of the canyon, the towering cliffs wreathing them in shadow and cold. The surfaces of the rocks were smooth and glassily transparent, as though vitrified by intense heat and striated with what looked like gleaming metal. Perfectly round gemstones were buried within the heart of the rock.
"Fascinating," said his father. "The surface has an igneous look to it, but appears to be metamorphic. Do you know the substance of the protolith?"
"No,"
said Valerian, suddenly wishing he knew more about the formation of rock and had more specialist equipment here.
"I don't even know what that means."
"Ah, no, I suppose you wouldn't," said Arcturus. "Metamorphic rocks come about when a pre-existing rock type, the protolith, is transformed into something altogether new."
"What sort of thing could cause that change?"
Arcturus pressed his hand against the rocks, resting his forehead on the smooth face of the stone.
"Usually it's caused by high temperatures and the pressure of rock layers above, but tectonic processes like continental collisions would do it as well. Any sufficiently large geological force that causes enormous horizontal pressure, friction, and distortion could cause this. But I don't think we're looking at any natural phenomenon here."
"Why not?"
"Because whatever caused this transformation, if it even was a transformation, didn't take place over geological spans of time. I think it happened virtually overnight. But then I've just arrived. I'm sure you've looked more deeply into the geological formations already."
Valerian hadn't had the chance to go any deeper than observational study, but suspected his father already knew that,
and was bandying about his knowledge in an unconscious display of superiority.
"Of course," said Valerian, attempting to reassert his power. "My studies have shown that this formation is a blend of natural forces and artificial engineering. See here, where the natural camber of the rock has been molded and interfaced with what looks like some kind of metal reinforcement?"
Arcturus looked closely at the rock Valerian indicated.
"Yes, like a neo-steel rebar in Plascrete."
Valerian waved his father onward.
"Come on, let's go inside. It's quite something. You'll not have seen anything like it."
"Don't be so sure. I've seen a lot these last few years."
"Nothing like this," promised Valerian.
His father stood in the center of the cave, though to call it such was to vastly diminish its unbelievable, incomprehensible scale. It was a gargantuan cathedral of light and stone and metal, fashioned deep in the heart of a mountain by an ancient race of gods. For surely no beings but gods could have hollowed out so massive a peak and not have it collapse in the millions, probably billions of years since they had first devised the means of its construction. Gracefully curving ribs of rock soared overhead, each one thicker than the hull of a battlecruiser. Corbels the size of siege tanks jutted out of the walls, and airy flying buttresses supported hanging finials and graceful descending archways of stone. Distance rendered them slim and delicate, but Valerian guessed most were at least 20 meters thick. The very walls seemed to shimmer with internal bioluminescence, scads of light darting along the lengths of metal set in the stone like flickering embers of electrical current. Gems pulsed with a faint glow, as though in time with an infinitely slow and inaudible heartbeat. Fluted stalactites descended in tapering spears, penetrating the roof like an inverted crown of ice pushed through the mountain's summit. A light mist hung in the upper reaches of the enormous cavern, a cloud system that kept the air moist and reduced the internal humidity. The interior of the cave seemed to point even more conclusively to a deliberate hand in its creation, its scale making a mockery of any such human constructions. Entire fleets could fit within this enormous cavern, and, for all Valerian knew, perhaps they had.
"It's incredible," said Arcturus, and Valerian was surprised to hear genuine emotion in his voice. "I've never seen the like."
"Told you,"
said Valerian, pleased he had been able to surprise his father.
"And do you think this is alien?"
"Don't you?"
replied Valerian, surprised at the question.
"I suppose it's possible," conceded his father. "But even if it's true, what does it matter? Whoever built this is long dead and gone."
"Aren't you curious about who built it? What great secrets we might learn from them?"
"Not especially. They are nothing but dust now, and no one remembers them. How great could they have been?"
Valerian's frustration at his father's obstinate refusal to grasp the enormity of such revelations grew with every word Arcturus uttered, and his temper began to fray. He realized he'd been sucked into his father's reality by the man's apparent interest in the ancient cave. Valerian shook himself free of it, as all the things he had wanted to say to his father suddenly rushed to the forefront of his mind.
"Where have you been all these years?" he blurted. "Why did you never come for us? Didn't you care for us?"
His father turned from his contemplation of the vast cavern, its majesty forgotten in an instant, as he saw that the pleasant fiction of a father and son bonding was at an end.
"It was too dangerous," he said simply. "The Confederacy wants me dead, and if they knew where you were, they would use you to get to me. There's no great mystery to it, Valerian."
"My mother is ill," said Valerian. "Did you know?"
"Yes, I know."
"Do you care?"
"Of course I care," snapped Arcturus. "What kind of childish question is that?
childish. Is it childish to wonder where you were when the mother of your son is dying?
Aelin told me our mother's cancer was inoperable, said Arcturus. Is he right?
He is,
confirmed Valerian, fighting to control his anger and hurt.
And all this running from planet to planet and moon to moon isn't doing her any good. It's just making her worse.
And what would it have achieved if I had come rushing to your side? Save puts you both in danger, said Arcturus. Did you want me to come and help you hold your mother's hand as she lay on her deathbed? Is that it? Well, Valerian, I'm sorry, but that would have achieved nothing. I have greater concerns and comfort in you, or your mother.
Valerian wanted to launch himself at his father and wipe the uncaring expression from his face with his fists, but he kept his anger locked tightly within himself. Though he hated to admit it, Valerian found himself admiring the man's ability to think logically and focus in the face of what would have broken the composure of a lesser man. But still, he had things to say to his father that needed saying, regardless of whether or not they would penetrate his armor of conceit. Greater concerns? Like overthrowing the Confederacy?
Exactly, said Arcturus. And such a goal requires sacrifice. We have all lost people in the course of this war, son, including me, my parents, Dorothy, Acton.
Who?
He was my father's head of security and a good man.
What happened to him?
He was on Cor Hall when the missiles hit.
Ah.
But their deaths will gain meaning when the Confederacy lies in ruins. And you and I step in to fill the void. We can do it, Valerian. I have an army behind me that is the equal of anything the Confederacy can field. It's only a matter of time until they break, and we can rule what they leave behind. But we can do it right, and found an empire for the good of humanity.
The good of humanity? Spat Valerian. You mean the benefit of the Manx dynasty?
Arcturus shrugged.
I see no difference between the two, he said.
And you want me beside you? Said Valerian, trying to keep the hope from his voice.
Of course, replied Arcturus,
coming over and gripping his shoulders.
You are my son, and you are a Manxk. Who else would be worthy to stand at my side as my successor?
You didn't think so before, pointed out Valerian. I heard what you said about me. You called me bookish, effeminate, and weak.
Words spoken in anger long ago, said Arcturus,
dismissing the hurt his words had done with a wave of the hand.
But look at you now. You have done me proud, boy, and I'm impressed. I can't pretend I'm not. You have achieved a lot since I saw you last.
I didn't do it for you, father, he said. I did it for me.
I know that, and that's good. A man should never do anything to impress others. He must always do things on his own, and for his own sense of validation.
And what if I don't want to be your successor? Said Valerian. You've been controlling my life from afar for so long now. I think you've gotten used to the idea that I'll always jump at your command. Well, I'm not like that, father. I am my own man, and I make my own decisions.
His father smiled and nodded, letting go of his shoulders and sitting on a nearby hunk of fallen rock.
I remember saying something similar to my father long ago.
Valerian felt the anger drain from him, and took a long drink of water from a plastic canteen he removed from his back.
Did it do you any good?
Not really, said Arcturus, accepting the canteen from Valerian. I called him a terrorist and a murderer, but now I've done far worse than he ever did. I guess if someone does something truly terrible to you, it's easier to justify your retaliation, no matter how vile it is. The Confederacy killed my family and obliterated my homeworld. What could I possibly do that would approach an atrocity of such magnitude?
I don't know, said Valerian. I don't think I want to know.
Then what do you want, Valerian?
I want to be part of your life, but I want to make my own destiny.
I said that to my father, too,
replied Arcturus. However, I have since found that time and history have a way of sweeping us up and making use of our talents, irrespective of what we might want.
What do you mean?
I mean that destiny will sometimes force us down the road it intends for us, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Is that what you think happened to you?
Maybe, but I don't think so.
Why not?
Because destiny dances to my tune, said Arcturus.
Valerian laughed at that, but the laughter died when he realized his father wasn't joking. Chapter 17 Destiny Dances to My Tune.
The words came back to Valerian as he watched the gigantic AAI hollow screen in the main commercial square of Gramercy City, capital of Tirador 8. Fully 30 meters wide and 9 high, the artificial advertising intelligence projected an image atop a shimmering podium before a giant skyscraper. Normally, the AAI advertised clothes, soft drinks, or the latest model of ground car, but today promised to be quite different. A flickering three-dimensional image of his father's face hovered over the podium, for once speaking to those who watched without interference from Confederate censors or UNN editors. Upward of 10,000 people filled the square, traders, shoppers, businessmen, refugees, criminals, and enforcers of the law, all silent and filled with nervous excitement as they listened to the words blaring from the speakers set within the podium. The voice of Arcturus Mengsk spoke over a magnificent tableau of stirring imagery, sweeping landscapes, and wraith fighters flying in formation.
"Fellow Terrans," began his father, his voice booming its pronouncement like that of a stern but magnanimous god. "I come to you in the wake of recent events to issue a call to reason. Let no human deny the perils of our time. While we battle one another, divided by the petty strife of our common history, the tide of a greater conflict is turning against us, threatening to destroy all that we have accomplished."
Valerian watched the faces of the people of Gramercy City around him, feeling slightly in awe of being in so vast a crowd. Until recently, the largest number of people he'd seen gathered in one place had been a dozen or so servants in his grandfather's home on Umoja, which seemed so long ago. It was like another life. Taking refuge on Tirador 8 had been Valerian's idea, hiding in plain sight in the midst of a populous planet. Though given the fate of the Confederacy in recent months, and this current announcement, it looked like their enforced flight was now at an end.
"It is time for us as nations and as individuals to set aside our long-standing feuds and unite," continued the stentorian voice of his father as the image on the screen changed to mighty battlecruisers sweeping majestically over Korhal. "The tides of an unwinnable war are upon us, and we must seek refuge on higher ground, lest we be swept away by the flood."
An image of a Confederate battlecruiser on fire, from stem to stern, filled the viewer, and the crowd cheered, a collective outpouring of decades of repressed anger and frustration. Valerian's father continued,
"The Confederacy is no more. Whatever semblance of unity and protection it once provided is a phantom, a memory. With our enemies left unchecked, who will you turn to for protection?"
The montage of images moved on as the cheering continued, the shattered Confederate vessel replaced with juddering shots of what Valerian now knew were a Protoss ship, and a snapshot of a Zerg higher organism drifting in space.
The devastation wrought by the alien invaders is self-evident. We have seen our homes and communities destroyed by the calculated blows of the Protoss. We have seen firsthand our friends and loved ones consumed by the nightmarish Zerg. Unprecedented and unimaginable though they may be, these are the signs of our time.
Flashing, violent images of battling wraiths sped across the screen, though what they were shooting at wasn't clear.
The time has come, my fellow Terrans, to rally to a new banner, demanded his father. In unity lies strength. Already many of the dissident factions have joined us. Out of the many, we shall forge an indivisible whole, capitulating only to a single throne, and from that throne I shall watch over you.
A tingle ran up Valerian's spine, but he couldn't tell whether it was one of relief or dread. His father's words had sounded more like a warning than a promise of protection. The image returned to the soaring spires that were even now being rebuilt on Korhal, amid the ashen devastation of the Confederates' spiteful attack. The camera closed on the buildings, finally settling on a huge black flag bearing a symbol that had become familiar to everyone over the last few years. A red arm holding a whip in its fist, the whip forming a circle around the arm. The Sons of Korhal. The camera lingered on the flag as his father delivered his closing words.
From this day forward, let no human make war upon any other human. Let no Terran agency conspire against this new beginning, and let no man consort with alien powers. And to all the enemies of humanity, seek not to bar our way, for we shall win through, no matter the cost.
Static formed a glittering column of white noise as the voice of Arcturus Mengsk faded and was replaced by the unwavering symbol of the Sons of Korhal. Valerian turned away from the enormous AAI as he heard the familiar snap and sizzle of the holo projectors firing up to repeat the message once more. Valerian had no need to hear it again. He had memorized the words as soon as he'd heard them. He turned and made his way along the crowded thoroughfares, pushing against the tide of jubilant people making their way toward the central square. Valerian found a side street he knew, and on it a small coffee house he frequented. The shop was empty when he reached it, and Valerian helped himself to a hot drink, making sure to leave a few credit notes on the scuffed wooden bar. He took a seat by the window and watched the cheering crowds pass by, their faces alight with joy. Valerian knew that the people here would, for a while, remember this day with golden memories. The day the hated Confederacy was overthrown and replaced with... Well, no one had been sure until today who would step into the void of authority left by the Confederacy's sudden, shocking demise. No one except Valerian Mengsk. He had known exactly who it would be. Today's sector-wide broadcast had only confirmed it. His father had declared himself Emperor Arcturus Mengsk I of the Terran Dominion. But no one was yet sure of the legitimacy of his claim. Valerian had heard some people talk of elections, while others cried out in support of a man who had, until recently, been condemned throughout human space as a terrorist. Never more was the aphorism about history being written by the victors about to be proven correct. Destiny dances to my tune. In the 3 years since he had heard his father speak those words, Valerian had come to understand his ultimate aim. He'd seen his suspicions turn to certainty as, over and over again, his father had defeated every force the Confederacy sent against him
with a combination of guile, brute force, and displays of utter ruthlessness that still had the power to stagger Valerian when he thought of them. Indeed, the last year had seen a multitude of changes, all of which had come with such unprecedented speed that it was hard to process them with any degree of comprehension. Humanity's first system shock had come with the news that the worlds of Chausara and Marsara had been destroyed by a fleet of ships belonging to an alien race known as the Protoss. The second had followed soon after when it became apparent that both worlds had been destroyed to ensure the destruction of a second alien species, a species whose name soon became synonymous with wholesale destruction and parasitic infestation of world after world, the Zerg. Valerian's initial excitement concerning the now indisputable evidence of alien life had been dampened somewhat with the realization that neither the Protoss nor the Zerg were likely candidates as the builders of the ancient structures. He decided they were temples of some sort that he'd explored on Van Osten's moon. The Zerg were a vile agglomeration of genetically mutable creatures, driven by bloody instinct and an insatiable hunger to devour, while the Protoss were a strange, aloof race of psionic warriors. Though this latter race possessed technology far in advance of, and just plain different from that of the Terrans, it did not seem likely they were a resurgent branch species of the temple's builders. The news that humanity was no longer alone was greeted with horror in some quarters, religious ecstasy in others. Some people wanted to greet these new arrivals with open arms and hearty welcomes, while others, savvy to the current zeitgeist, armed themselves for war. This latter group were to be proved the more perceptive. With the arrival of these alien races, open warfare ignited throughout Confederate space, with local brushfire skirmishes flaring into full-scale revolts. And of course, Arcturus Mengsk was there to fan the flames. Refugees fled before the tides of this increasingly ferocious war, and conflicts revved up from terrorist attacks to full-fledged planetary battles throughout the sector. Thousands were dying every day, and calamity followed calamity for the Confederates as they lost their grip on their colony worlds, one by one. Then came the destruction of Antigua Prime. The truth had been suppressed, of course, but Valerian had it on good authority from his grandfather that the great Arcturus Mengsk had used stolen psi emitter technology to lure the Zerg to the Confederate colony to defeat his enemies, which had in turn drawn the Protoss there to scour the planet bare of all life. The terror that had followed this catastrophe spread through what remained of the Confederate colonies like a virus through a fringe world shanty town. The stream of refugees became a raging torrent, and freighters crammed with terrified people fled in thousands from the epicenters of the fighting to the Outer Rim territories. Valerian remembered his mother's reaction to the news of his father's complicity in the death of Antigua Prime, seeing her visibly sag at what the man she had once loved was becoming. Valerian had realized some time ago that his father's once noble ideals of throwing off the yoke of Confederate tyranny and ending the corruption of the old families had withered and been replaced with a desire for an empire of his own. His mother despised what his father had become, but Valerian secretly admired the single-mindedness with which Arcturus pursued that one ambition, knowing that one day it was destined to be his. The thought still struck an ambivalent chord within him. Not long after the destruction of Antigua Prime, his father had ordered Valerian and his mother to find a new refuge, one far from the core worlds of what remained of the Confederacy. It was typical of his father to send such a blunt message, but Valerian had sensed something deeper behind it, as though some terrible event was about to be set in motion that required Valerian and Juliana to be as far from it as possible. He hadn't known what that was until news reached them of the fall of Tarsonis, capital world of the Confederacy. Like Antigua Prime before it, Tarsonis was overrun by the Zerg, drawn there by his father to destroy his enemies. The old families who had murdered his parents and sister and consigned millions of people to death on Korhal. As acts of vengeance went, Valerian had to admit it was a masterstroke. Bold, without mercy, and unstoppable. The Confederacy died with Tarsonis. It had been the linchpin of human space for so long that without it, the colony worlds folded and collapsed, leaving Arcturus Menx's dominion triumphant in the ruins of his enemy's defeat. No sooner had the Confederacy fallen than his father had made contact, telling him that the time was approaching when he would bid Valerian step into the light as his son. Valerian couldn't deny the attraction of that idea, for he was now 18 and ready to take his place on the galactic stage as a force in his own right. He was his own man now, intelligent, erudite, charming, and capable, able to fight with sword, rifle, or rhetoric, as the occasion and honor demanded. But whether he would be the successor his father imagined? Well, that was another matter altogether. Valerian finished his drink and left the deserted coffee shop. "Time to go home," he said. In the end, it was another 6 months before Valerian was to see his father again, the demands of building the Dominion from the ashes of the Confederacy taking longer and placing more demands on the newly installed Emperor than had been foreseen. Valerian hadn't minded at first, content to spend time back on Umoja at his grandfather's house with his mother, now that they were free of the need to move from place to place to avoid Confederate kill teams. But as the weeks turned to months, his impatience grew, and the enforced idleness of life on Umoja began to grate on him. He was the son of an emperor, yet had nothing of importance to do. His mother's condition had progressed, with every remission followed by a resurgence of the invisible sickness that was consuming her. New technologies had slowed her descent, but hadn't been able to stop it, and the doctors had solemnly informed him that she could only last another 6 months at most. They had been saying that for years, though, and his mother had surprised them all with her dogged tenacity and courage. Between periods of caring for his mother, Valerian's days were spent honing his already fearsome skills with a blade and gun, under the stern gaze of Master Miyamoto. His old tutor had accompanied him back to Umoja, and had declared Valerian the best student he had ever taught. He devoured every digitome he could get hold of, learning everything he could of the Protoss and Zerg. He scoured the information networks for any sign of fresh alien ruins. But in the aftermath of war, archaeology was no one's priority save his. On this evening, Valerian walked behind his mother in the gardens of his grandfather's house, following the path toward the river, which glittered like molten copper in the sunset. She had bid him accompany her to the riverbank, and they had set off as the servants prepared the evening meal. Juliana ate little these days, but Valerian's appetite was as hearty as ever. He wore a form-fitting suit of charcoal gray, knee-high boots of gleaming black leather, a double-breasted jacket with more than a hint of the soldier to it, and a scarlet cloak draped around his shoulders. His hair was unbound and fell about his shoulders in a cascade of gold, the image of his mother's in her prime. Now that there was no reason to hide his ancestry, and every reason to display it, Valerian proudly wore a bronze wolf-head medal of the Menx family upon his breast. His mother sat in an automated wheelchair, controlling its movements,
with an alpha wave reader fitted just behind her right ear. Returning to Umoja had done more to restore his mother's constitution than all the years of drugs and painful chemotherapy. Intramuscular nanostimulators had prevented her muscles from atrophying completely, and it was wonderful to see some of her vitality restored to her. Even though Valerian knew she could not last much longer, he loved that she smiled again, now that she was home. The air was clear and crisp, the umber sky warm and like honey over the distant horizon as the day drew to a close. The scent of the air was heavy, and Valerian took a deep breath, instantly transported back to his boyhood, in a time where he was innocent of the wider scope of the galaxy around him.
"It's good to be home, isn't it?"
said his mother, her voice thin, but stronger than it had been in many years.
"Back on Umoja, I mean."
Valerian nodded.